Radio Gorgeous, podcasts for women.
Radio Gorgeous. Today on the Radio Gorgeous Red Sofa, I have Frances Welch, author of The Imperial Tea Party. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you very much for having me, Donna.
The Imperial Tea Party tells the story of the three meetings between the British and Russian royal families prior to World War I, shall we say.
Prior to the revolution. I mean, there were other minor meetings, but these are the substantial meetings between the Romanovs and the British royal family, one of which took place at Balmoral in 1896, when only Olga was born, the oldest Grand Duchess. The next one took place at Reval, which is now Tallinn, in 1908, and the last one was at the Isle of Wight in 1909. And 1909 was the only time that the whole family came to England. So I've always been very obsessed with that. People who are keen on the Romanovs will probably have seen pictures of the family at Barton Manor next to Osborne House on the Isle of Wight, because they're well known. But in a way, that's how my interest in the book started, was with the Isle of Wight. And then I worked back to the Balmoral visit and then Reval.
Okay, let's start with that Balmoral visit, where Queen Victoria was present.
Yes, the Balmoral visit should have been a wonderful occasion, a wonderful reunion between Queen Victoria and the young couple, as they then were. That's Nicholas and Alexandra and their baby. But in fact, it was blighted firstly by the rain, secondly by the Tsar. The new Tsar, as he was then, being unable to hit anything when he went out hunting or shooting. He was taken out by Bertie, that's the future Edward VII, repeatedly in the rain. He failed to hit anything, got rather distressed about that. And his third problem, aside from the raining and the shooting, was that he kept on being collared by people to take part in political conversations, as he called them. He said that there were more demands on his time at Balmoral than there were back in St. Petersburg. And he, Queen Victoria was always wanting to talk about the Sultan and the Sultan and Turkey. They would travel in carriages, and Nicholas would suddenly find himself alone with the Queen, Granny, as he called her, and she would start going on about the Sultan, and that was annoying for him. Bertie wanted to set up some kind of Anglo-Russian organisation. The Tsar didn't want to discuss that either. And then he also had the Prime Minister, Lord Salisbury, trying to bend his ear. And he had two conversations with Lord Salisbury, one of which went terribly well, where he was agreeable and Salisbury absolutely, you know, really took to him. That by the time the second one took place, unfortunately, the Tsar had spoken to his ambassador, who was at Balmoral the night before, and he'd completely changed his mind, because he usually agreed with whoever he'd last spoken to. So he changed his mind. Salisbury was cross, and that night the Tsar had a tooth abscess, and that was the terrible sort of curse at Balmoral, the worst one, because he then couldn't sleep, and he said he can't go out in public with a swollen face. So that was his stay at Balmoral, I guess not so successful.
Okay. And yes, exactly. And also, but what's wonderful about that is that it does show, yes, and it exemplifies why we're fascinated by our royal families, and the different roles that they played then and now, because they're very human.
They're just human. Yes, exactly. That's absolutely right. And I should have mentioned that the important person in a way at Balmoral was the Tsarina, Aleki, as Victoria called her.
Yes, and tell us,
they had been very close.
Tell us about that relationship, and exactly, for those of us who are less au fait with the exact family trees who Aleki was in relation to Princess to Queen Victoria.
To Queen Victoria, yes, she was Aleki, as she called her, was the daughter of her favourite daughter. Can I say that? I'm not sure. Princess Alice, who died when the Tsarina was only six. And presumably Victoria was terribly distraught. Anyway, she kind of adopted little Aleki and took it upon herself to try and find her husband for her. She tried to get Alex or Aleki together with Prince Albert, who was the older brother of George, the future George V. Sorry, I don't want to muddle everybody. But anyway, she had tried to create a marriage with... To create a link to the British royal family, but Albert was homosexual and he was feckless and he wasn't really a suitable husband anyway. However, and he died very young. But
aside from all that, though,
you know, she could have Queen Victoria, in a sense, was right to you know, to warn Aleki or try to stop the Tsarina from marrying Nikki, who she'd been obsessed with since she was about 12. Because
why
of what happened to them.
Why was Aleki so attracted to the future Tsar Nicholas?
I don't know. I suppose yes. To be honest, I'm not quite sure. Except certainly, if you compared him to some of the other people that were presented to her as eligible bachelors, he might have been. Well, he was good looking. He was sort of sensitive. She might have liked his humility. I mean, certainly she made the most of it and soon got her own, you know, got her own rule in. But she might have liked the fact that he was quite humble. He liked music. I mean, he was a sort of vulnerable character. He wasn't a forceful man. Her sister had married a Russian. Actually, that marriage was not a great success because that was Nicholas's uncle Serge. Grand Duke Serge, he was homosexual, and in fact was assassinated. That marriage of Alexandra's older sister Ella was not a great success. But Ella kept saying to Alexandra and anyone else who would listen, "Come to Russia. You know, this is what I've done. I've married this Grand Duke, presumably before it all went wrong. You know, please come here." And she sort of paved the way.
And it did seem like the marriage between Aleki and Nikki, the Tsar and Tsarina, was a love match.
It was absolutely a love match, yes.
But they were ill-suited to public life and political life.
Yes, I think that's possible. I think she was perhaps too domineering. But it's very hard to know what they were like because to make judgments about their characters in a way, because they were so much they had to adapt to whatever happened to them. And of course the huge tragedy for the Tsarina was her son having haemophilia, not being able to cure him. And then of course Rasputin came in, this very controversial character, but she believed this man of God came directly from God, could cure her son. And her espousal of Rasputin is sometimes seen by people as the reason for the revolution. Mm. And Nicholas had, you were asking about their relationship. I think if Nicholas had been a bit stronger, he knew what public opinion was about Rasputin. He did occasionally complain about Rasputin coming to the court, but he couldn't do anything. I think she used to say, she wore the trousers in the relationship, and she used to say, "Russia likes to feel the whip." She probably believed that, but then she found everybody turning on her.
Yes.
So.
Well, and also in that meeting in Balmoral, I think, or perhaps in the later meetings, I mean, she had a lot of physical problems as well. She had sciatica, and didn't really like being in public that much and being viewed.
She did. She was very self-conscious. Mm-hmm. Yes, hated being in public. And she, as you say, she had these sciatica, a sort of a heart murmur. I mean, her children's diaries are full of, "Oh, mother's heart is 1, 2, 3, and 4, and 5. And they, the children became obsessed with her heart as well, which I which I think is bad. I think if you are being neurotic and you need to keep your neuroses to your, away from your children if you can.
But
she did have, all these symptoms, yeah. Mm. And I was going to say the second Dr. Botkin, who died with them in Ekaterinburg, certainly believed that they were real and that she had a bad heart. But yes, she wasn't very. She hated the public life. And Mr. Gibbs, the Romanoffs had a tutor called Mr. Gibbs, who was from Rotherham, and I wrote a book about him, a biography of him. And he felt that Queen Victoria had a bad influence on the Tsarina because she made the Tsarina more likely to be stiff and haughty. Gibbs said that the Russians like to act out their lives. They like to be sort of flamboyant. And she was, you know, very reticent. And this was thanks to Queen Victoria. That's what he said.
Yeah, I mean, people did view... It seems as though Russians viewed her as cold.
Exactly.
And then also that she just had all these daughters before she had her son.
Which was a terrible tragedy as well.
Yeah.
And that also... These immense tragedies meant that she was then vulnerable to so-called men of God or spiritual healers, and who had been in the court for years before. Rasputin was certainly not the first. But because of these things that she couldn't control, like whether she could have a son, and then when she finally had a son, he was ill, she was reduced to these what could be frauds. And it was very hard to tell whether they were fraudulent
quacks,
or not.
We might call them.
Yes, and it's exactly, and it's sometimes said that, well, if the presence of Rasputin calmed her down, the fact that she calmed down made the son calm down, and if he could lower his blood pressure, then it might be that he would be he'd be losing less blood.
Yeah. But getting back to the relationship between these two families, like any extended family, and with your in-laws, there were tensions between that became apparent through these three meetings and through what there's official evidence. I mean, the Tsar kept notes on what he did, but like most royal notes, they are factual as opposed to filled with feeling. So we know what they ate, we know who was where, in a sense what was talked about, but the general feelings, we don't know. But we can see, especially between Bertie and Nicholas, that there were tensions built through these meetings. There was sort of a macho sort of push me, pull you between those two.
Yes. Well, there was a problem in that I suppose Bertie was older. You know, that was undeniable. He was the king. By the time of the Reval meeting, he was the king.
So at the second meeting, he was king.
By the time of the second meeting in 1908, he was king. And I suppose the Tsar thought, well, I'm the Tsar of all the Russias. He's the king. We should, in fact, be equal, but we're not. But not least in a way to defend Bertie slightly, because the Tsar was much younger. And he also said, well, Nicholas is as weak as water. He didn't rate him. He himself was a sort of rumbustious character. And in fact, he emerged quite well from my research. Particularly the Russian ambassador, Benkendorf, was really fond of him and had no time for George V. He just thought, George V has no charisma. He really defended Bertie. But I've since been speaking to people who say Bertie was an absolute horror and awful and nasty, which you couldn't say about the Tsar. But I wasn't there. But I was, I think I thought it was wonderful in a way that he was rumbustious and positive, and all the rest were so reticent and negative, I suppose, about everything.
Well, and also they were all awkward throughout the Tsar's entire reign, from the very first, when there was a stampede and about 1,300 people died at his,
at the Kadinka Fields, yes.
and then going out, you know, on the advice of his uncles, you know, going out to a party that night. But then also during these meetings at Revel and then again on the Isle of Wight, they, both Bertie and he, wear the, they give each other these titles, you know, because this is a very regal and formula thing that royal families confer titles upon each other, and so so-and-so is head of the navy and da-da-da-da-da. So there's Nikki, you know, the Tsar of Russia, wearing, you know, an, a British uniform, and Bertie squeezed into, you know,
his Russian uniform that doesn't fit.
I mean, and these but, and you can see there's this posturing. You can see it in politics now, you know, but there's this really uncomfortable feeling, and also possibly contributing to sending the wrong message home.
Yes, yes, very, very possibly, yeah. I mean, Nikki wrote to his mother saying, I can't, you can imagine how awful it was to say goodbye to my crew in an English uniform. That was at Balmoral. But he was always saying in his diary, I mean, he didn't say much in his diary. His diary keeps his cards quite close to his chest, but he does, you know, I have had the uniform on now for 12 hours, but now I can take it off. This is the British uniform. And meanwhile, Bertie couldn't get into his. And then when they were making each other admiral of the fleet, it turned out that this was at Reval, that the Russian fleet only consisted of one ship, because all the rest had been sort of blown up at Tsushima. But oddly enough, quite often these you know, these rather excruciating moments pass the Tsar by. He's the one who doesn't. I mean, he didn't complain at the Isle of Wight. There was another problem with the two different, the contrasting fleets between Russia and Britain, in that they sort of toured the they went on the Victoria and Albert, I think it was, rather than the Standard, and sort of went up and down the lines of the British fleet, and it was huge, it was immense, and the Russian foreign minister and some of the diplomats were very were upset by the size of the British fleet. But again, no mention of that from Nikki, which I suppose perhaps shows again his humility. He wasn't upset by that, but unfortunately the rest of the entourage was a bit, I think.
Humility and perhaps naivety.
Yeah.
Well, you can't imagine Putin standing there taking that in this day and age.
I know. Yes, exactly. No, I quite agree.
Another thing that came through, the detail that you provide about these meetings, is the opulence that must have also fueled Russian hatred of the of the Romanovs and the royal family, because every time they left, you know, they showered everyone in sight with, you know, gold snuff boxes and Fabergé eggs and rings and this and that. They were always giving gifts every time they went, which on one hand is nice for the recipients, but it was a very opulent show.
Yes, I quite agree it was. I'm not sure what the attitude of the people was to that, but oddly enough, I think the king was slightly alive to that, because I saw a letter that he'd written saying, we do not give out, you know, willy-nilly, he didn't use that expression, but, you know, medals and, you know, at random, and in brackets, like the Tsar does. We're a little bit more careful about who we give what. And yes, it was. It does seem opulent, but again, it does show that he perhaps didn't realise how it looked from the outside. Then you also have to remember, I suppose, that most of the spending was probably on security, because everybody was, you know, we haven't really touched on the security aspect. Which,
let's move to that, because also that really played a big role in an Isle of Wight, you know, and then the Grand Duchesses, you know, were walking down the street and there was a big riot and stuff like that. But also, you know, there had been attacks on the royal family at that time. So there was heightened security and how they traveled and the coaches were. Give us some of the detail of that, of what was going on around that.
Yes. Yes, well, oddly enough, when I give talks at literature festivals, which I have, I usually read out the security. I mean, it's quite extraordinary for all three meetings, really. There was a sort of rumours of a dynamite conspiracy to murder the Tsar. That was before Balmoral. At Reval, it was, which was quite a long time after, you know, 12 years, they decided that the only the meetings could only take place offshore. It sort of wasn't safe for the for any meeting to take place on land. And they had sort of more or less decided that for the Isle of Wight. And in fact, some of the papers said to the left-wing factions who were all saying, we do not want the Tsar, you know, Nicholas the Bloody, we do not want him on British soil. We don't want him here. There'd been a big outcry before the Isle of Wight. And the papers said, no, don't worry, he won't step on British soil. But actually, of course, he did. As I mentioned earlier, there are all these photographs of them visiting Osborne, or the house next to Osborne, which is Barton Manor. But it was an enormous, you know, hundreds and hundreds of plainclothes policemen at Balmoral.
They said there were things like people being tossed out of their cottages and, you know, Russians moving in for the duration.
Yes, a huge entourage. Yeah. Yes, yeah. That's it.
And which then, is also, again, visually and impactfully, you know, a show of great power and wealth, you know, spent on just this family.
Yes, yes, it is. But it's hard to know when it, you know, when the adulation switches to sort of hatred and anger, because, you know, the two girls were spotted in Cowes High Street, and then this created a huge security problem, and then finally people from Scotland Yard had to clear the streets for them to go, to clear a passage, because everybody was mobbing them, coming, following them into the jeweller's shop, Benzies the Jewellers on Cowes High Street. And that was sort of, as far as we can tell, that was kind of adulation. But you never know when it's going to go wrong, or who was in amongst the crowd. Mm-hmm. Because there was a lot of sort of problem underground, I think. I mean, at Reval they had a man who, Azef, who was considered to be a bona fide Russian guy working for the Russian police, who was in fact a double agent. And meanwhile, we in London, we apparently had very lax security through the sort of 1890s and on, which is why Lenin came to live here, and we had Prince Kropotkin, mm-hmm. who was this Russian aristocrat who lived in London, who actually went back to Russia just after the revolution, he managed. But then he found that the revolution had already gone sour. Within sort of 6 months, he realised wasn't going to work.
This is not for me.
I thought, yes, because he delivered a great statement. Oh, we have successfully launched a revolution with no bloodshed. This has happened. How amazing. Actually, that wasn't true either. But anyway, when he got there, it all sort of went wrong pretty rapidly.
But yeah, and London was at that time sort of a hotbed of socialism, mm. and, you know, so, and there was
the radicals. Yeah,
you really feel through, sort of tangentially through the book, because it's focusing on the royals, but you feel tangentially around them, because they were also at this time heads of state, that there were things could go off, like it was like a powder keg.
Yes.
You know, things,
yes.
Things were very,
yes.
very sort of unstable.
Yes. And I suppose that's what George V finally thought when, you know, when the opportunity came to, after when the revolution happened, after the revolution, the new government, the provisional government, said, didn't know what to do with the Romanovs, and said to the British government, please, can you, you and the king, invite the Romanovs to England, Britain, we don't know what to do with them. So an invitation was duly issued.
Because Nicky and
Georgie,
King George
had been close.
Were close. They looked so similar. There's pictures from Barton House,
yes.
which seemed like a very idyllic time.
Yes.
And sort of the nicest and closest and easiest amongst the families of the
visit. I think they did. I mean, as I said before, the Tsar wasn't always keen to have political conversations, and I think Georgie probably wasn't either. So they used to talk about holidays in Denmark, which they'd shared when they were children. Both their mothers were Danish. And anyway, so yes, it seemed obvious that Georgie would invite the Romanovs to Britain. So the invitation was duly sent. But then Stan Fordham, who was George's private secretary, said, this is a really bad idea. This is going to destabilize the country. It's going to, you know, we're still at war. This is 1917.
And there had been one demonstration, I think, anti-monarchist demonstration. And he sort of used that as the reason, this could be the end of the monarchy.
Yes, and end of your life.
Yeah, you know, and to me, it seemed like to show that that Nikki and Georgie were actually quite similar, that they were both easily led.
Yes, yes. No. I quite agree. But I hadn't realised. I mean, and I've written about it before, the invitation and the withdrawal of the invitation, and I've read the ambassador's daughter's book and. Obviously, I've read around it quite a lot, but I hadn't realised quite what a fight Stan Fordham put up. Because Lloyd George, originally, him being the Prime Minister then, he said, no, we can't withdraw. We said we'd have them.
We sent an invitation. Yes, suck it up.
And you gave the authority.
Yes, you said
and
yes.
Now you're saying we can't have them. So Lloyd George put up a fight. Anyway, for years, Lloyd George was blamed. It was blamed on him because that seemed to be more convenient for everybody. And he changed his autobiography accordingly. He didn't mind, it has to be added. He doesn't mind that he was deemed to be responsible. He didn't rate the autocracy in Russia at all. So he didn't mind. And Mountbatten, who was the son of the Tsarina's sister Victoria, was still saying in 1971... It was Lloyd George, you know, which, anyway, I suppose. But then in 83, Kenneth Rose wrote his book in which he prints out all these letters, the exchange of letters. And it is shocking to see how he sort of ramps it up and up and up and up with King George's approval.
It has to have been.
Until finally Lloyd George said, oh, okay, or Balfour, it was the foreign minister then, okay, we'll let it go. Now, the other thing, though, to add is that it's probably unlikely they would have come. They were ill at the time. And, of course, a lot of people in Russia believe that they wouldn't have wanted to leave. I mean, a lot of people in Russia, don't forget, believe that the Tsar is a martyr and a saint, and he couldn't have been a martyr and a saint in Britain.
And left.
No.
You gotta die. If you're gonna be a martyr, the downside is you gotta die. It's part of the gig.
Yes, you've gotta stay.
Yeah.
So they would argue. Yeah, absolutely. And they would argue that there's no way that that Nikki would have wanted. At one point.
What do you think?
About.
Do you think they would have come?
Well, now you're asking me now, just here. My feeling is that they were too unimaginative or naive, or I don't think they had any idea what was in store. Of course, if they had, well, the people who believe they're martyrs would believe that that's what they were planning to do on their road to Calvary or whatever. But my feeling is that they. Couldn't believe it. Wouldn't have been able to believe what was in store, and therefore wouldn't have left.
Yeah.
Because, even the Tsar's mother had to be sort of almost coerced into leaving. After all, her family had been killed. She didn't believe that they were killed. By the way, incidentally, she died in about 1930. But
really,
well, yeah, she kept refusing to believe. But she they had a hard time when Georgie heard that Nikki and the family had been killed, and he finally. He tried to not believe it for a while, but then when he finally accepted it, he sent out a British battleship to get the Dowager, the Tsar's mother, from the Crimea. She was way down south. And several British admirals went out there to try and persuade her to leave, had a terrible time getting her to leave. She did finally, but she felt she was abandoning her country, you see. And imagine, that's what Nikki and Alexander would also have felt.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I sort of feel it's unlikely they'd have come. But we haven't really been forgiven. I mean, in my life, I've been challenged several times by people. You know, your family just, not your family, but the royal family, just abandoned the Romanovs and failed to. I mean, whether they could have done some rescue operation later on, that's a whole other thing.
Or whether they would have sent their children and stayed themselves.
Well, yes, I was going to mention that at one point, the Tsarina's sister Victoria, who lived in England, she's the one who's the mother of Mountbatten, she said, please, she wrote to Balfour saying, please, who was the foreign minister then, what about the girls? You know, I can see that the Tsar and the Tsarevich, this was perhaps in 1918 even by then, they were killed in July 1918. What about the girls? Anyway, Balfour said, you know, he would try, but it was a forlorn hope. In other words, there was absolutely no chance. Yeah. But yeah, why not allow the girls to leave? But you see, they probably would have said they were amazingly close family. I mean, was there any chance of separating any of them? So
it did have, and also, I mean, of course, hindsight allows one to do this. But you do sort of feel almost that there was, through these meetings and the relationships and how they, what it exposed about them, there was sort of an inexorable inevitability, you know, and a momentum towards this sort of outcome.
Well, yes. I mean, if you feel that, then you're going along with the people who believe he's the Tsar, saint and martyr, if that's what you think, is that they were on that road. Yes, she had the Tsarina had a thing about redemption through suffering, and she threw herself into her suffering.
With full abandon.
In a big way.
I wanted to ask you if you thought, I mean, as you just said, that there are some people who are very unforgiving about the invitation being rescinded. And I was wondering if you thought, if there were reverberations through the royal family, even through today, and how they deal with certain things that stemmed from that decision. If there are things you feel that we still, still echo down.
Well, I'm not sure about now. People have so little sense of history, I think. But I know that George V was clearly haunted by the whole thing, because he... as I said, the Dowager was rescued eventually in a British battleship in 1919. They finally got her and the Tsar's sister. And the Tsar's sister ended up living at Windsor with George
V. Really?
What's
her name? Olga, I think.
She is Ksenia. Is another one, Olga. Yes, absolutely. Okay. But it was Ksenia who was there. And it's her grandson who's written a little... Well, he does these... pictures of his life as a child, which have little captions, and a lot of his pictures are of Windsor and the tiny little house that Ksenia and her children and grandchildren were assigned, and then you can see that the castle in the background where the British royal family were living. And there was one day, Andrew Romanov, who is now 95, he remembers as a child going cycling in Windsor Great Park and seeing the Queen, the future Queen, and saying, "How do you do?" in English. And she probably replied. I'm not quite sure if he says whether she replied. Anyway, he then goes back to his little cottage, and a call comes through from the castle saying, could the Romanov grandchildren please stay out of the Windsor grounds when the royal family's in residence, which shows how George was feeling about the whole thing. I think, was it guilt or was it just misery? It's an unforgivable thing to say, in a way, to say the children who've suffered so much, or the Romanovs who've suffered so much, can then not be received properly and not... but I can see that he was probably trying to protect his own grandchildren from, you know, that this
from
misery.
the knowledge. Yeah,
yes, because what
he wasn't going to look good in their eyes.
He wasn't going to look good, but the whole, even without him, the fact that they were all murdered, that his cousin was murdered is not something you want to tell a child, I suppose. Mm. And I do sympathise with that.
I sympathise with that, but there's something very possibly British about, you know, sort of them being tainted, you know, the Romanov children being tainted by
tainted
the tragedy.
By suffering.
Yeah, by yes. the tragedy. Yeah. Nobody wants to see that. You know what I mean? But there is sort of that element, like,
oh, I know.
Over there.
Yes, there was a poet called Robert Southey who used to go on about the voice of woe because he was disturbed, having his, you know, in 1800, disturbed at a pub lunch by a pregnant woman, you know, at the window, crying. And he said it put him off his meal, having the voice of woe. But yes, that's it. Yeah. But that's awful. I feel very ashamed. Do you think that's just a British thing? Is that what you're saying?
Possibly. More so than other places, although not exclusively. Let me put it that way. Not exclusively.
Yes.
But so, and now we have to get to the crux of the matter for you. What is you are clearly entranced, fascinated with the Romanovs and that whole story and Rasputin and that whole time. What about it has it captured you?
Why did that happen? Yes, I agree. It is odd. I've written 5 books now and maybe about to do another one.
Yeah, so but, you can't say it's not a focus.
Well, the thing was that when I was very young, Robert K. Massey wrote this book, Nicholas and Alessandro, which I think was the first, I could be wrong here, but I think it's the first of popular history which told the story of the Romanovs. And there were pictures, photographs of Rasputin, photographs of the beautiful children, photographs. And my father was a right-wing journalist, and he was very keen that I should grow up hating Bolshevism and communism, probably. So he showed me these
garbage.
Yeah, he showed me these pictures, you know, and all these children were murdered and how outrageous that was in a cellar in a Katerinburg. And anyway, I've never quite got over it, and Dad, my father, and I used to discuss it periodically. It was a sort of safe area for us to discuss, you know, because it was very moving and tragic, and yet it wasn't us, you know, it was somebody else. Does that come back to what you just said?
Yes, exactly. Was it your own voices of woe?
Yes, these other voices of woe. But I think I was just entranced by that story, and so that even I worked on a local paper for 4 years in London, West London Observer, and then I was freelance for a while, and then I interviewed people for the Sunday Telegraph about religion for about 10 years. But the abiding thing is always, and I had done a couple of, I did a sort of oral history book of women who remembered the revolution in the course of that time while I was working at the Sunday Telegraph, and then, oh, that's right, I was working for Time Watch. On the one of their revolution commemorative revolution programs, and we interviewed the son of the tutor, Mr. Gibbs. Mr. Gibbs was gay, but he adopted a boy in Manchuria, and the boy was by that time living in Oxford, and that's how I got on to Mr. Gibbs originally. Unfortunately, by the time I got on to George Gibbs, the son had died, but there was plenty of other material, and I really enjoyed that, even though it was a very short book, actually.
So you got in via Mr. Gibbs?
Sort of by Mr. Gibbs, yes, but I had done the oral history, I suppose, before. Mm. But yes, Mr. Gibbs, and then I did a book about the false Anastasia, which she ended up in Charlottesville. I mean, she was very kooky. As you probably know about her, she lived with some 40
yes.
cats and a mad genealogist, and that was a sort of crazy story. And then the third one was the rescue of the dowager and the Tsar's sister from the Crimea, mm-hmm. which I mentioned earlier. And then I did a biography of Rasputin. That was the last one.
So, as you mentioned, what might be the next one?
Oh, well, I'm not sure. I'm just thinking about something now.
Okay.
Right. And I'd like to, you know, in theory, I feel it's probably time to move on, but I'm not sure that I'm going to be able to, because it's just one of those, if you're very self-generated, self-motivated, self-motivating and it all has to come from you, then you have to be very sort of passionate about whatever it is you're doing. And I'm not sure there's any other subject that can get me going. I mean, I was commissioned to do the Rasputin book. I wouldn't have done that normally. That was a straightforward, well, relatively straightforward biography, but I mean, he was a very old man, so it's not, nothing's very straightforward about him. But basically, otherwise, it's me generating books, and I have to be very keen. I was very keen to do the Isle of Wight. That's really how it started when I, you know, imagined them at the Isle of Wight.
Anyway. Excellent. Well, we will be watching this space. Thank you so much, Frances.
Thank you very much for having me. Thanks, Donna.
RadioGorgeous.com.